From the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Well, there's a whole bunch of silly stuff going on out there in the world of money and government and dollar stuff. And so no telling where we'll end up today, but we always end up somewhere with Andrew Goss, and it's always fun. I've got a bunch of cool stuff, really interesting article with Jim Sinclair. You know him, Andrew Goss? Jim Sinclair?
Oh, yeah.
And he goes way back. Yeah, he's got quite an interesting background. And he's got a letter that he's written. He's got a thing to the Gold Council that I'd like to go through this show and help us to understand some of the things that are being said here, because they sure sound interesting. And we'll give you Jim Sinclair's background. Andrew Goss' background is quite simple. He's a nice guy. He's up in Hawthorne, New Jersey, with his family. He has a coin company called SDL, and they have two offices, one in Hawthorne there across the river, and then one in Hilton Head, his partner Fred. And then he's a currency historian, and he's been studying this money stuff for about 35 years or so, and he buys and sells gold coins for a living, because he said this business found him once he understood how the monetary system worked. Then you figure that, Andrew, maybe gold and silver is probably a good
thing. Only way.
The only way to go, yeah.
state
making gold and silver thing like that.
I remember Greenspan's statement. He did the foreword for Ayn Rand's book, Capitalism, and that was way before he was anything. And he said at the time he wrote this, gold was illegal for Americans to own.
Huh. Well, it was at one point, right?
Right. Yeah. And he said that if anything else was better than that as a means of protecting you against this inflation, then government would have to make it illegal also.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, Andrew Goss, with every country in the world creating a fiat currency made by fiat. Tell us what that is again, because I used to think fiat meant...
Edict.
I used to think fiat meant said it was just not backed by anything, but it's deeper than that. It's by edict.
Yes.
So King Henry says, you see these little rocks with my picture on it? These are worth whatever.
This is money. And if the people said, no, we want these chunks of gold or these chunks of silver, he said, no, by law, by edict,
by my
fiat, this is money.
So fiat is a command?
Well, it's actually a little car made in it. No, fiat is. See, yeah. Now, okay, so I'm a book reader.
I wasn't ready
I'm
for
a book
it,
reader. Probably. I'm a book reader. And when I saw the word fiat, that's how I said it, F-I-A-T, fiat.
Yeah.
I've heard a couple of professors pronounce it fiat.
And, Greenspan has
says fiat.
Says
yeah.
fiat as well.
Yes, yes.
So maybe it is fiat.
Yeah, but I saw fiat. I knew
I understand. Well, we'll probably keep the word fiat because nobody knows what fiat is.
Yeah.
Right? It's all fiat.
It's fiat.
So it's by edict. So I'm king and I say...
These pieces of paper that I sign are money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Nothing else is money. This is money.
And then back in the day, you've taught us, this is kind of fun. Back in the day, there's a term used currently called quantitative easing, which is, I just love that one. You know, it's...
We need to ease the quantity.
Ease the quantity of money, George, whatever.
It reminds me of P.T. Barnum in New York City in 1845, right? He had... He had this museum of wonders, and he would charge people $5 or whatever, $2 to get in. I think it was really more like a quarter or a dime. But anyway, so once they paid their admission, they would just stay there. They would just never leave. And pretty soon he's up to capacity. He can't sell any more admissions. So he comes up with a great idea. He takes a sign, hangs it on the wall, see the egret.
See the
No, excuse me. See the egress. egress.
Egress, okay.
Egress. So there's an arrow pointing to the egress, and people go to the back, and there's a door, and it says, this way to the egress. And when you open the door, it slams shut behind you, and you're standing in the alley outside. Egress is another word for exit.
Exit, of course, yeah.
Right, so we know that today, but in their day, they didn't. And so by using a word that people didn't recognize, they hide the true meaning of what they were doing, which was leaving the museum. And so it's the same thing in these words of art. When they say quantitative easing, what they mean is devaluation. But they don't say it because, obviously, who's going to go to the egress on purpose?
Yeah, I mean, if they say, well, you know, the ECB has been devaluing the euro by, I don't know, whatever it is. It's a huge amount. I mean,
but it is a fraction. So all you have to do is, let's say you have $10 trillion in circulation and you add a trillion. You've just devalued the currency by 10%.
So on paper,
if they wanted to tell us what it was, they could, but instead they tell us it's the egress. No, excuse me, it's quantitative easing.
Yeah, but all the kids in the cheap seats are out there right now on this May 17 morning saying, "Now wait a minute, no. If they just print a trillion and they got 20 trillion, and then that's 5%.
Roughly.
How come my organic coffee didn't go up 5% next week?"
Oh, it doesn't instantaneously happen that way. Mm-hmm. It slowly makes its way through the supply chain. And many times people don't immediately go to the boss and ask for a 5% raise, although they should. And manufacturers don't immediately raise their prices 5%, although they should. But back in the day, when we had lawful money, gold and silver coin, and Congress said, okay, we're going to do the coinage act and we're going to change the value of the dollar. So in order to change the value of the dollar, we need to tell everyone, okay, a dollar is no longer 0.8 ounces of silver. Now a dollar is 0.7734 ounces of silver. So they just devalued it. Then they pass the law and the president signs it and everyone goes, okay, so the dollar is now worth 5% less. I'm going to raise my prices. I'm going to lower my prices, whatever, to match what has just happened. And absent that, we don't know. And that's really why it's so insidious, because you hear quantitative easing and you don't realize we're just going to engage in a round of quantitative easing. What does that mean? What does it mean? Well, it means we're going to devalue the currency. And all the while, the currency or the money that you own is also devalued.
Okay. I get that.
Let me stay on that for a minute.
A
second.
Okay.
Let's say that you had a gold and silver coin standard, and many people, like when I talk about coins before the age of Jackson, 1838 and before, and before we changed the standard, once they changed the standard of what a dollar was, it was a little less gold, and they did that with the Coinage Act. Then the coins that were issued before that date were worth more than the coins issued after that date.
Right.
And so people just melted them down, took the gold out of them, took the silver out of them. That's why it's so hard to find a coin from before the age of Jackson.
Okay. So back in the day then, even in King Henry's and all that, and the boys back there, and the Romans, their way of quantitative easing was kind of cool, you taught us. And I think I first learned this in the Secret World of Money book, is that they would actually clip the coins.
Yes.
They would clip the folks.
Or sweat them.
They'd sweat them or clip them.
Yeah.
And then one guy would have a full coin, right? And the other guy would have a clip coin with not as much gold, but they were worth the same thing. By law, by fiat.
Right. That's right. Well, by
virtue, clipping or
yeah,
whatever.
Exactly.
You know, whatever they did.
By virtue of the fact that they were the circulating money. But the Romans also debased their coins. So they simply reduced the content of the gold when they were minting them, or reduced the content.
Oh, they would
of
just
the
make
silver.
It a little bit smaller.
Yeah,
like that,
or the same size, but with an alloy. Instead of it being, you know, 100% silver, 90% silver, and then it was 80%, then it was 10. Mexicans did
hey,
the same thing.
Hey, George, you got 2% silver back
exactly.
there.
Exactly. And the Mexican peso is another good example. You know, in the 1930s and 40s, a Mexican peso was made of 900 fine silver, and by 1967, it was 100 fine. So it was 90%
wow.
in the 40s, and
good
it was
for them.
And it was 10% by 67, and then they just took the silver
I'm
out
sure
altogether.
I'm sure that wasn't on the label of the coin when you bought it.
Right. No.
On the label, contains 10% silver.
Contains less than 10% silver.
Only 90 calories.
Tastes just like real
fruit. Tastes just like real silver. Well, that's pretty clever the way they do that. Now, so then can we conjecture is that as things get more and more and more and more digital in this blockchain and who knows where this all
yes,
going, right?
That's where it's going.
You know, so then you're going to have, just like you do with Bitcoin, you can buy a 0.000002 bitcoins, correct?
That's right. Correct.
Right? I mean, I don't know. You can
the
buy
fractions go backwards.
Fractions yes. go backwards. It's going to be the same thing with the dollar.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Did I hit on it?
You hit on it exactly.
That's what they're going to do.
The substitution thing
these
is what
these boys, these rascals, these guys, these, yeah. these scallywags.
Well, if you could count on government to maintain the purity of your coinage. Then it was the banking system, first in our case, that substituted the bank note, or the piece of paper, I owe you a dollar, yeah. for the actual dollar. And that worked for a long time. I mean, you know, the idea that people could come back to the bank with their paper money and say, give me my gold coins. By 1934, the banks didn't have to worry about that anymore. Now all they had to worry about is that they had a sufficient quantity of paper. Because as people came in with their electronic money and or check money and said, here, cash this check. And then they would hand over paper, banknotes. But as we've seen from the H41 release, there's only $1.5 trillion in paper.
That's it.
So now the fear of the banks is, and it's happened many times, so people
now they're going to go to digits, right?
Right, because they, you know, the same way they took the gold away and said, look, if people didn't have the ability to come into the bank and ask for these gold coins,
we
could do a lot more. And they did a lot more in terms of expanding credit. And so now the thing of the bank says, well, if we didn't have to deal with this pesky paper, this cash, we could do a lot more. And so the drive and the push is on, a war on cash. To eliminate cash everywhere.
Every,
you can't pay taxes, you can't, in New
every
York
country,
City.
Every country.
Yeah, you can't take a taxi with, I mean, using cash.
Really? You can't use cash in a taxi?
No, they discourage the use of cash.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's good for
them. They want digital payment. Starbucks can't cash a $100 bill in Manhattan, you know, and paying with anything greater than a $20 bill. So the 50 and the 100, in my opinion, and the 100 real soon, will be removed from circulation under the logic that we don't need it. Mm-hmm. You know, anything bigger than $50, you should just use your electronic money. And if you have $100 bills, well, you must be a drug dealer.
Well, but I don't think you can just ditch a $100 bill. I think because Putin's got a couple pallets in his basement.
You bet.
I mean, you know,
70%
all countries got a lot of $100 bills, right?
70% of the $100 bills in existence circulate outside the United States.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Because that's like the creme de la creme of currency around the world, right?
Turkey. Well, and it's why the super notes were counterfeited by the Iranians back in the late 80s.
Those guys.
Yeah, well, they did it with a printing press that Jimmy Carter sold to them.
Oh, good for Jim.
Jimmy Carter actually sold them one of our printing presses out of the Philadelphia Mint and then sent technicians to Tehran to calibrate it. And then the East German secret police got the plates, near perfect $100 plates, and sent that down the line. And so by 1985, 86, in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon, there was a printing press cranking out near perfect $100 bills. They had to change the currency. Yeah.
Well, Jimmy was probably smoking those sweaters that he was wearing.
I don't know what
he was
doing.
You smoke those sweaters.
Hemp sweaters.
Hemp sweaters. You get a little silly, you know, there in the White House during the 70s. Jimmy Carter. It's
Jimmy
May 17, 2017. Well, I mean, was Maxine Waters out there in the 70s saying that they should impeach Jimmy Carter for sending the Iranians a printing press? Because
he was talking to them.
She's out there this morning. You know, she's going to go to, she's on the floor of the House right now. saying that they should impeach
absolutely everybody. Every Democrat in the every their hair's
Andrew
on fire,
Carlson,
man.
What is going on? Is this a coup right in front of them? I mean, is this what's going on?
Well, it's exactly what they did to Andrew Jackson. Exactly. I mean, there was no
try to run him out of the place, man.
Yeah, they regroup and attack, and in this case, obviously, if I said something, I hope you'll be able to let this go, is what he's accused of
and
saying.
He said, our Flint is a good guy, you know. Maybe
he's a good guy. I hope you'll be able to let this go.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
you'll be able to let this go.
Well, if he's got tapes, he should play them. If he's got tapes and he doesn't want to play them, he should burn
them
now.
Wait a minute.
He should burn them now before he gets a
You're the FBI director. If you believe that the President of the United States has just now ordered you to obstruct justice and you don't immediately report that crime and take action on that crime, well, then you've committed a crime.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well,
so,
good for you,
Comey, you thought he was telling you to do something, undue influence, that's obstruction of justice. You should have immediately referred that to the Justice Department or done something to have it prosecuted. Or you didn't believe it. It was like I would say, geez, yeah, he's a hell of a nice guy. I hope you'll be able to let this go. I didn't just tell you to let it go. I expressed my desire, my hope that you let it go. I don't see that rises to the level of obstruction, but it doesn't surprise me that they're all over him like a cheap suit.
Well, but something like this, you couldn't impeach him, or could you? I guess you could.
Sure, you could.
Impeach him. I mean, you could if you could prove it, but it's
even if you can't prove it, impeach means indict in government terms. That's what it means.
So we'd have to go through the process.
You impeach him, then you give him a trial.
Yeah.
And then he's either censured, like Andrew Jackson was, and he was bitter about being censured by the Congress.
I bet he was.
Man, he was bitter. Years later, he expressed that bitterness, but that's about the extent of what they did to him. So they could theoretically bring President Trump up on those charges that he tried to unduly influence. But if they prove that charge, then I think Comey should be indicted for failing to report it.
But they don't have the votes to even bring it to a thing, do they?
Well, therein lies the rub, doesn't it, right? It's only if remember what I said about globalists versus nationalists,
yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. If they don't have the votes, yeah?
Maybe they do.
Maybe the globalists have the votes.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
But
well,
don't think that just because it's a Republican Senate and a Republican
course.
Congress
yeah.
that somehow he's going to get a slide on this.
Well, of course not. And, of course, John McCain and his crew, man, they just don't like Mr. Trump at all.
No, they don't.
They would love to have him out.
Yep.
Well, I think it's kind of did they, when they impeached Bill Clinton, did they censure him?
Nope.
I
don't believe they did. Forgive me, I'm not as, didn't have anything to do with money.
So you weren't paying attention, yeah.
I knew that it was a smokescreen, that whole affair certainly,
the whole thing.
I use that word inadvertently.
So currently, it costs you $1,886 for a Bitcoin. And so just like you said backwards, you can go in there and say, I'd like to invest $100 in Bitcoin, and you'd get .00000123 Bitcoins or something like that in your account, right?
Right.
Uh-huh. And it's great because then if you are blackmailing somebody, then you can
get paid anonymously.
You can just get paid in Bitcoins, which
it's everybody trying to gather up Bitcoins. This is
right.
funny. It's a supply and demand market, isn't it? And everybody trying to gather up Bitcoin to pay the ransom on their computer system has caused the price to spike.
So these guys
now, I suppose that on the day that the hackers go to cash in the Bitcoins to get real money that they can spend, the price will plummet. So without a central bank, unfortunately, Bitcoin is subject to these roller coaster activities.
So these hackers are wanting to, they're blackmailing, Universal or one of the studios because they got a copy of Pirates of the Caribbean Part 5, and they're going to release it, on YouTube or something. If these guys don't pay them, I don't know how many billions of dollars. But now, just say if the studio would relent. Now, I know they tried with Netflix, and they Netflix said, you know,
go ahead,
tee it up, which they did. They released Orange is Black and something.
Orange
like that.
Is the New Black.
Orange is the New Black or something. So just in theory, Universal Studios says, okay, we'll give you 1 million bitcoins and just don't release the Pirates of the Caribbean. Is it that tight of a system where it couldn't be traced to get these people? No, how would you know?
Anonymity, that's the prime feature of the Bitcoin. Yeah.
So they could actually get away with it, something like that with Bitcoin?
Oh, yeah.
I guess people are paying them $300 in Bitcoins, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's going to be damaging for Bitcoin because the resentment, many public institutions caught up in this, many governmental institutions caught up in this.
Yeah.
And when they realize that the money trail goes cold at Bitcoin, man, they will do everything in their power to warm it up again.
The boys don't like that when the trail goes cold.
They want to know. They want an auditable trail of every transaction, and this one doesn't work that way. But as I've seen in the past, if you recall, there was a bunch of short options on the airlines the day before 9/11/01. Mm-hmm. Remember?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. These are on registered exchanges.
Short options. People sold the airline short.
Short.
Because they knew something was going down, as they say in the movies. Something's going down.
And so the spike in these short purchases would have indicated some sort of foreknowledge. And so as the investigators went on down that trail, we never heard another thing about it.
Because nobody could cash them in.
Well,
maybe
they know who bought the options, for God's sake.
Oh, do they?
They know who bought
the options. Oh, the Saudis did, right?
Yeah, well, let's just say that the trail led back to a place that they didn't want to lead it to. So I imagine the same may be true for Bitcoin. Who knows how many underground politicians and what other sort of personnel are taking their payments in Bitcoins.
Yeah, I already got the real story of this one for a future screenplay is the Gov, right? The boys, the boys, they hire the hackers to do the,
Well, we did, this is true. We did develop,
hack, right?
That is a military.
I know. Yeah. Well, actually, I think it's probably already true because it's an NSA thing that they use, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's one of theirs, like Stuxnet, that was developed strictly to take out the Iranian nuclear power system, was then hijacked and modified and used to hijack computers. And this one is exactly the same thing, where, go in and encrypt your hard drive. And so now we have all of your data encrypted and you can't open it anymore. So there goes your whatever program you're trying to engage in. This was developed by DARPA. You remember them? Defense Advanced Research Project.
How can we forget?
The Total Information Awareness, yes. So they develop it with our taxpayer money. It then the hackers get hacked and the program gets stolen and modified and is now being used against us. Now, if somebody did that with a Tomahawk missile or any other munition, you can bet. And I recall most vividly in the mid-90s when I put in the sort of encryption in my computer system that would prevent anyone, including the government, from getting into it. And they were offended. I was using a munition. The encryption that I was using was classified as a weapon. Why on earth are they allowing these weapons to leak out of the lab like this? Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem right.
Well, maybe it's all planned. Maybe it is.
It is the Hegelian dialectic.
So they're going to be able to demonize Bitcoin.
Yes.
And then there you go. Then
we need regulation on this thing.
And who would benefit from that?
The banking system that currently holds the monopoly on the issuance of money.
Who benefits, right? Who
benefits? Key Bono.
Is that what it is? K Bono? Is that like Bono's Sonny Bono?
Like Sonny, yeah. Who benefits?
888-663-6386. Email Patrick at oneradionetwork.com. I tell you what, you do a little pine pounding in the morning, have a couple shots like I do, and you will benefit greatly. Here's master herbalist Stephen Buhner giving some insights, guys, on why this pine pollen could boost your testosterone levels.
The pollen itself is extremely high in a number of male estrogens, the most potent of which is testosterone, and it's got a fairly high level of it. I mean, it's still in the micrograms, but that's really all the difference between us and women is that we have this microgram more than they do, and then in the womb, that shifts us into the male developmental pattern. So when we start adding that stuff back in to our bloodstream, which you do if you take that sort of tincture and you hold it in your mouth for a while and then you swallow it without putting it in any water or anything, it goes right through the mucous membranes into the bloodstream, and so you start to get an increase in the body of actual testosterone, which then circulates to pretty much every cell in the body, and that then begins to increase vitality and muscle strength and everything else.
This is a great product. I've taken it for years. You can click and order an Easter Thrival link, different variations in the pine pollen, potency and price. Take your pick right here on OneRadioNetwork.com. You know, this One World Way is a pretty spiffy kind of cool thing to try and to use for you and the family and the kids. I mean, when you think about the simplicity of it, the purity of it, you know, the grass-fed, non-denatured, grass-fed pasture, you know, grass-fed, grass-pasture-raised, which is just an amazing amount of nutrients. I had two scoops this morning with the colostrum that I'm drinking now. And you talk about, it really tastes yum. So the kids, Mom, if you could get a little, you know, 22, just one scoop of 22 grams of protein in the kids every day, I mean, that would be huge, you know. And then you could put some fruit in there or some coconut milk or almond milk and get a chocolate vanilla strawberry. And boy, you know, they're going to drink, just, you're going to drink it. They'll support it. They'll digest it well, as you will, and your significant other will. And it detoxes heavy metals because of the whole glutathione thing. Lots of immune function, stratosphere, you know, kind of moving that thing up. Brain function, mood, lean muscle. It's really a cool thing. Lots of energy. People will use it to lose weight, where they'll just stay as in a meal. And then and it'll carry you right on through too, depending on how you juice it up and how many scoops and all of that. One World Way, their chocolate, vanilla, strawberry. We appreciate your ongoing support of this great product, so give it a try sometime. It's right on our website.
Know the source on One Radio Network.
It's the Real World of Money with Andrew Goss. Once again, here's Patrick.
Well, thank you very much, Shirley, once again. And Andrew Goss is here, May 17. Well, just with Andrew Goss, people kicking around the I word, the impeach word, in the media, because they've been having great fun with it. Gold is up $20 this morning. Silver's up 11 cents. Market's down a couple hundred points. You know, you have these things going on. They definitely disrupt markets, right?
Yeah.
Is it uncertainty? Is that why the money boys don't like this? Or are they just profiting, doing more longs and shorts and selling this and trying to profit from whatever chaos they see coming?
Yeah, well, it's probably more the entire monetary system is based on confidence, right? And the growth patterns trumpeted by the current administration are all based on this confidence, you know, make America great, et cetera. And if the chief architect of this is now so busy that he has no time for things
bailing
like tax
bailing
cuts,
the boat, right?
Right. Yeah. Then we're not going to get the corporate tax cut. We're not going to get the new jobs. We're not going to get the 4% growth. We're not going to get any of the things on the Trump agenda because he's going to be spending all of his time fighting. And so the more it looks like that, the less confidence investors have and the less they're likely to invest in the U.S., especially now that all the green lights are flashing in Europe. You know, the euro, strong as it's been in a long time against the dollar. Folks are saying, well, without Le Pen, we got Macron, we got a banker in there, and he's going to do things that are good for us and the investor. So it's the shift in investment flow from the U.S. to the euro has weakened the dollar, and that's what's caused gold to go up.
Well, I don't know. I know this is just nonsense to talk about, but man, if I'm there advising the president, I tell him just to let it all go and just do what you do. And,
yeah.
And if you guys
ignore
say, if you guys got something, you know, bring it on.
Bring it.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's the boy. That's what I would do. But of course, Mr. Trump is not wired like that. He's not going to do that. He'll be
no.
be tweeting and twittering all day long and get involved with this and. And I think that's one of his shortcomings. He doesn't really understand. You know, I guess he's got a too big ego to do that. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know,
maybe.
But, you know, what are you going to do, man?
Yeah.
Yeah, what are you going to do? 888-663-6386, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. So, yeah, if you don't get to do the whole tax cut thing and the Obama thing, that's going to be a little, you know, his base is not going to like that, right? The people that, or the wall thing, those are the three big ones, right?
That's right.
Yeah, they're not going to be happy at all. They'll be out there protesting against him too. Jeez. This is kind of interesting. The Treasury collected $1.9 trillion so far in the fiscal 17, which is September through today.
Correct.
$1.9.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's interesting how they put this out, and which shows you how they don't even hide this anymore. They're getting 945B from personal. Good for
Correct.
Them. They get 160B from corps. Wow. Us people.
See why? That's right. Nine to eight times as much. That's why the 35% corporate tax cut, cutting that 35%.
Not a big deal, right?
No, not in terms of revenue. So if we're going to cut that 167B, instead we're going to get 60.
Who cares, right?
Right, because the bulk of it is from the payroll taxes, the income taxes. So individual income taxes means every one of those companies that now hire new workers, put on more payroll, create more jobs.
It'll actually be more taxes.
That's right. Increases the individual side. Yes. Mm-hmm.
President Trump needs a whiteboard to explain this, and were you helping him? But I guess he's not. I know they get 154B from other. I don't know what that could be. That's probably.
Well, they get a bunch from the Fed. Remember, the Fed pays them a franchise fee.
Oh, maybe that could be it.
Yeah, that's some of it. Yeah, and then there's user fees and other revenue that total that amount.
Uh-huh. And then a big one, of course, 870 from Social Security, which is almost as much as personal. So, you know, they don't even hide the fact that they're not using trust fund money for the Social Security, right?
Well, no, they took the Social Security money.
Yeah, I know,
money,
they took it,
but they put in the trust fund.
This is part of their income, I mean.
But they put in the trust fund an IOU.
I know.
So they've double booked that revenue.
Those rascals.
They've showed it into the trust fund, okay, and then now from the trust fund into the Treasury. Hey, two places at once.
Yeah. It's magic.
That's how they control inflation.
Mm-hmm.
By having you put the money away for one thing and then borrowing it and spending it on something else. Now it's doubled the potency of those dollars.
Oh, and diluting yours at the same time.
At the same time, because of the 845B in IOUs, which is additional created money that's not counted in the money supply. But make no mistake, it's P, right?
Potential, right?
Potential money, no question. And the Social Security recipients are not going to say, you go ahead and keep it.
Can one just imagine if that money wasn't stolen, they played fair, right? Played fair,
yeah.
And they would have borrowed the money. And if they needed it, you know, to spend on stuff, they could have borrowed it from the Fed and other people and just had more debt. Well, that's in the, well, it's not in the state of debt. Is that what they owe Social Security and the $20 trillion?
That's intergovernmental, yes, that is. It is
so it's already in there anyway.
That's right, but it's not in the $100 trillion that we really owe.
Right, but if they would have why didn't they just borrow it with Treasury notes and leave the trust fund alone?
That's right. Then the trust fund would be free to sell the Treasury notes into the open market, and they think of the power that they would have. That would even outstrip the Fed,
or use it for mortgages, right? Or like you said.
Well, that's an entirely different concept.
That'd be
but
cool.
Yeah. That would be extremely cool. My plan was to tie Fannie Mae and the Social Security Trust Fund together.
Sure.
Let the Social Security Trust Fund fund Fannie Mae and let Fannie Mae issue individual mortgages to individual Americans that are not poolable. They're not able to be put into these mortgage-backed securities.
And would they go through a bank to do this?
No.
Just a broker?
A broker who would just... assign the loan over to, yep, boom, gets their check.
Or you cut out the bankers, though. You would be getting impeached. You know what I'm saying?
At least impeached.
Because you cut the banks out of the whole deal, right?
Yeah, man. Ooh.
Yeah, you know, I thought about that this morning. So you had talked to us and told us about fractional reserve banking and how if you go to Wells Fargo, borrow $200,000 for a home, right? And then they create the money and then go to the Fed and blah, blah, blah. It's just all new money, right?
That's right.
Does Wells Fargo pay taxes on that?
Wells Fargo does, yeah.
On the $200 million?
Wells Fargo pays taxes on its revenue, on its earnings. But the central bank itself, the Federal Reserve Bank that Wells Fargo owns a part of, is not subject to tax on its revenue.
Right, but and that's who Wells Fargo owns.
Wells Fargo owns
the Fed,
part owner
of
the Federal
Reserve.
Yeah.
Oh, you see, but oh, so if Wells Fargo would happen to make a profit from Andy's loan at the end of the day, at the end of that year,
they get to deduct all their expenses, and then
they
whatever
would pay
profit
tax.
They make, they
but they
pay
don't
tax.
Pay a pure $200 million tax up front because they got to create it.
No, of course not. Not until the end of the day when we see whether I paid it back or not.
Right.
And if they made any money on the deal.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, they don't get any tax up front, even though they did, you're right, just create the money.
Mm-hmm. 180 years ago this month, the Panic of 1837.
Yeah, man.
The Panic of 1837. Now, let's see. People were actually demanding gold and silver, right?
Real money, yeah.
Real money. But then back then, they had already chiseled out about $4 out of every $5 for gold. Is that close?
Very close.
So in other words, for every $5 they had out there, they only had a dollar of gold. So, right?
You're absolutely right. Second Bank of the United States having issued all of this paper money, unbacked money, and was now forced to make good and didn't have it. So
why were they forced to make good?
Because the idea that they had a monopoly, you know, they had this check up, if you will. Once the doors are closed, it's like, okay, how many notes do you have? How much gold do you have? Cash in your notes, close your doors, right? That's it. That was the canceling of the charter of the Second Bank of the United States. So
this is when it was going to be canceled.
It was canceled. It was.
This is the War of 1812, right?
Yeah.
Boom, 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 boom. Okay.
No.
I'm sorry. Wait a minute.
The killing of the bank by Andrew Jackson.
Oh, this is Andrew Jackson's thing.
Of course.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of course. I lost track. Yeah. This is Andrew Jackson's thing.
Yeah. So they did everything they could, naturally, in the beginning. They tried to pay. But you know, this is the deleveraging process, the unwinding.
The messy part when Andrew Jackson took them over.
That's right. When you had to now delever. So where you had borrowed $4 for every dollar in gold that you had, now you had to pay back and essentially get rid of the gold because the bank is being liquidated. And so as the bank went through liquidation, calling its loans, and then the people that it called its loans from obviously used leverage to buy a factory or to buy a store and now had to sell the store in order to get the money to pay the loan, you see the deleveraging. That's what it's called. It's the same thing going on in China right now, the deleveraging, where you have to get back real. You're not operating on fictitious money anymore. Now we're real. As long as the game is continuing, that's why I've always likened central banking to a game of musical chairs. It doesn't really matter how many chairs you have, and think of the chairs as the gold coins. And think of the people walking around the chairs as the banknotes that represent the gold coins. As long as the music is playing, it doesn't matter how many chairs you have. You never stop the music. So no one is rushing for a chair. So, you know, you don't have one chair for every 10 people. Then you have 10 chairs for every 1,000 people. It doesn't matter because no one's rushing for a chair. Then the music stops. And everyone rushes for a chair. Well, that's what caused the Panic of 1837. Once Andrew Jackson closed the bank or canceled the bank's charter, then these hard times came upon us as everyone sought to liquidate property to pay their debts, deleveraging. And by the time of 1837 hit, they had squeezed every bit of real money out. And Well, they called it the hard times for a reason. We've talked about
and,
it.
And, you know, the one radio network, people were there listening.
Do you care to know why I'm in this chair with you all? I mean, why I earn the big bucks?
Why is that?
Yes.
Why is that?
Yes.
I'm here for one reason and one reason alone.
Yes?
I'm here to guess what the music might do a week, a month, a year from now. That's it. Nothing more. I'm standing here tonight. I'm afraid that I don't hear a thing.
Whoops. Grab a chair. Grab a deck chair. The music stops. And then you know who's who.
Yes.
Then you know who's who. So this is curious, Andrew Goss. A panic of 1837, the May of 1837, 180 years ago, Andrew Jackson was out of there.
Yeah, but his...
He was out of there in March.
Yeah, but his Van Buren guy, which was...
Yeah,
I mean,
so...
They were the same. It was like... They were twins, you know? If you look at any of the political cartoons of the day, where anything Jackson is doing, Van Buren is on the sidelines of the political cartoon cheering him on.
Oh, so the people, they elected another guy just like Jackson.
Exactly. It'd be like having Trump do 8 years and then...
And do, I don't know.
And then Pence.
Something like that. And,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so, but when Andrew Jackson stopped the whole Second Bank of the United States, this is the panic was, I don't understand why the Treasury and Jackson or Van Buren couldn't have quantitative easing some dollars to make things better.
Ooh,
why was there a panic?
Well,
why was there a panic?
There was a panic because, well, the idea, first of all, the... paper money was the enemy.
That's right. Of course, that's the whole Jackson's thing.
That was it, yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
So
yeah, he wouldn't do
there's
that.
There's no way they're going to say, we're going to issue more paper money. It was
okay.
You know, take the medicine and let's get it over with.
Let's get it over with.
And that's what they chose to do instead. So
the people that took fiat currency thinking that the bank had $5 and only had one.
Correct.
Those are the people that panicked.
Yes.
Those are the people that caused the panic of 1837.
That's right. They went to the bank and said, give me my money.
And they said, we ain't got it, dude.
That's what happened on May 10th, I think it was.
Yeah. It was just about
the banks in New York City said, okay, look, you bring your paper in, we're not going to give you gold. So.
Wow. So that must have, you know, that would go through the streets like...
Like shockwaves. Banks collapsed.
Now, was this all over the country?
Oh, well, it's touched off in the money center, New York City.
Right. But, I mean, if I was in Wyoming and I had a dollar...
It touched you, yeah.
I couldn't go in. So a lot of people lost a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of people did lose a lot of money. And, in fact, it was the deflationary depression that I talk about would happen if the central bank, like if the Federal Reserve today stopped monetizing debt.
Right.
And just worked with the money within the system.
Right. And got real, as we call it.
Well, even if they didn't get real, but they kept the supply of money fixed. No quantitative easing, no additional liquidity.
Yeah.
What we have is what we have, and that's it.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, each year, interest payments come due. No one's creating additional money, so those interest payments act as a drain on the system. And so it just gets that the dollar becomes worth more every year as there's more demand for dollars but no supply increase. So then businesses fail, prices decline, workers lose their job, people become pessimistic. They're not confident in the economy anymore.
1929.
Boy, isn't that the same.
Same
it was
thing.
Exactly the same. And so as this deflationary spiral played out, which is... We've talked about the price of real estate as an example.
Yes.
If there was no such thing as a mortgage, the price of real estate would plummet. If everyone had to buy houses based on the cash that they got in their pocket.
Prices would be 20% of what they
That's are right. Prices today. Would plummet.
Plummet.
So the same is true if you can't borrow money. If no one can borrow money, then you're forced to sell your business, your your house, your whatever. And as all these things come on the market at the same time against a fixed supply of money,
yeah.
then you get the reverse of an inflationary cycle. You get a deflationary spiral. And it isn't until all of the credit is wrung out of the system that the true value of everything is reached. And until it is, it's just a depression. People selling, 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 no one buying. And but, and that's what we had from 1837 to 1844.
1837, 1844.
That's right.
Right. So this was
deflation.
The hard times.
Yeah. Every year, a dollar was worth more. And this was the result of the medicine. So the sickness was that, obviously, we were inflating our money.
Right. And which is why Jackson took over the bank.
Cut
out the bank, right?
Cut out the bank, and he said, that's it. You know, we're going sound money, no more.
Whew.
And no treasury system of issuing money at all, and no monopoly power to anyone. If you want to start a bank, go ahead. If you don't, you know, if the people have faith in you, you'll succeed. If they don't, you'll fail. And we're not bailing you out. And, you know, it is what it is, as it were.
Yeah.
And in that environment, the dollar got stronger.
Of course it would.
And a stronger dollar means, well, what we had were years of deflation. So if you have a dollar and you saved it, and next year you know it's going to be worth $1.10 or $1.05, you're not going to spend it on anything. It becomes your investment. You'll just try to hold dollars.
Why did Andrew Jackson believe that this thing could go on if nobody was creating new dollars? How could the country expand?
Yeah, I mean, it can only expand through what today is known as pay-as-you-go.
So he didn't see that big picture, where he did, but he just, who
knows? Didn't believe that anyone should have the monopoly power to mobilize credit.
To mobilize credit, yeah.
Yeah, and so if you want to mobilize credit.
He was a real purist, then, wasn't
he? He was, yeah. If you want to mobilize credit for a canal, then you start a canal company, and you have investors pay money to join, and then you use the money that they give you to build the canal. If it succeeds, the investors make money. If it doesn't, well, you failed, and you lose money. That was the way that Jackson saw as everything should be.
How would you finance an army?
Well, you better collect tax money. You have the provision in the Constitution to fund an army for 2 years with an income tax. So, I mean, he could have taxed anything for up to 2 years, but that's how he would have done it. By simply raising taxes, which is, you know, if you look at the structure of our Constitution, where all bills for taxation are supposed to originate in the House of Representatives. So if the House wants to do whatever it wants to do, I don't care, pick your pet project, whatever, and it has to appropriate that money from the Treasury. And if it's not there, well, it has to raise taxes in order to get the money there. And then every 2 years, they run for re-election. So if you get a Congress in there that, we're going to go to war and we're going to institute a 25% tax in order to pay for it, and then we're going to run for re-election, we lose. Just that simple.
What a great system.
Yes. And so you couldn't originate a bill for taxation in the Senate, where those guys voted on every 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to do it in the House of Representatives, where the guys are replaced and gals every 2 years. Now they've, of course, passed that off by saying, well, we don't have to raise taxes. We could simply issue a bond, have the Federal Reserve monetize the bond. Now we have the money. We spend it on what we want to spend it. And by the time the people have to pay it back, and then we have to raise taxes, we'll be 10, 20 years in office. So they've managed to hide that responsibility and pass it off onto the Federal Reserve.
So it's easy to understand, just with that last 2 minutes, how the globalists, which are the bankers and the big corps and, you know, ADMs and the Monsantos and the farms.
Yeah, those
and
that
all
believe
the,
in the one world
boys,
government.
The one world government, the boys and all that. Why they've got such a juggernaut on the whole thing, right? On Congress,
right.
On Senate.
Yeah.
On the FBI, on the CIA, on the NSA. I mean, they
FDA, FCC,
they got,
FTC.
They got them all, these three. They got the juggernaut because they've got this system going that, man, it's pretty unbreakable. I mean, it couldn't even be dismantled now, Andrew, with what you've taught us now, could it?
No,
I mean,
no, it couldn't.
You couldn't go through the hard times to get real now.
Well, you could.
I mean, you'd have 4 million people in the White House lawn throwing spears, man.
Exactly.
That ain't going to happen, you know.
Yeah, we're so much more leveraged than we were during the age of Jackson. If we all of a sudden like that, that's why when Ron Paul and the boys, if you recall, started the Abolish the Fed campaign.
Right, right.
I tried not to laugh. I tried, you know, like, come on, guys, be serious.
You don't even understand.
If you abolish the Fed, what did I say? They would be tumbleweeds blowing through the streets of America's cities within a year.
Well, look what happened in 1837.
Exactly. That's why I know.
And now, you know, whatever, 180 years later.
It's no different.
Of how much derivatives and
You know, when they gave us this merger of law and equity in 1934, it was because these multi-state corporations, you know, the way it always was, we were an agrarian society. We were, everything was close to home. And you sold your goods in a distant marketplace, but you were paid in a local money, effectively, and you operated regionally, and as these businesses were typically hometown affairs, maybe state affair. So if you go into this state and you'll see this business, grocery store, what have you, and then you go to the next state and you see another business and also a grocery store, but entirely different from the previous one, and then these chains of companies started by national banks started to operate in all of the 50 states, and they said, well, you know what we need like a uniform central regulation. We don't need to be knowing the laws of all 50 states. Let's have a unified, uniform commercial code that's the same in all of the 50 states. And that's what we got in 1965. So the idea that we have a uniform law in all of the 50 states, this desire for uniform regulations has caused these people to now think a little bigger. Okay, we want now uniform regulations throughout the world. And we want to know that no matter what we do, we can do it anywhere. And so we need a law that we can all agree on. So even if you attribute this motive of altruism, that we all have to follow one law, common law, a single law that's good throughout the whole planet, and for that we need a one world governmental entity that enforces and gives us these laws, it's almost innocuous, right? Oh yeah, that sounds like a good idea, like a uniform currency where the money is the same in all 50 states. We didn't get that till 1913. Prior to that, every state had different banks that issued different money. So this idea of uniformity is what is driving us towards a global system. When I say globalist, don't take a negative connotation. These are just people who believe that we would be better off if the whole world was governed by one set of laws.
Those are globalists, one set of laws.
And for the world.
If they were all really nice guys, altruistic, very ethical and compassionate, and good souls that really wanted the best for everybody, you could probably do it.
Yeah, if you pass the Constitution.
You know what I'm saying. You know.
As the first order, you know, the first order, the Constitution becomes the supreme law of the globe. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll go with that. I mean, hell, we don't even pay attention to the Constitution here in the United States. You know, where is the jury trial for a matter in controversy exceeding $20? Where is the gold and silver coin called for in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 10 of the Constitution? Where is that separation of powers where jurisdiction doesn't overlap? States have the right to enforce these laws. Federal government has the right to enforce these limited laws. I see now where, did you hear about the organic farm in Oregon there?
Oh, we've been, yeah.
Have you been on that?
We put
there
on our Facebook.
Boy,
what a tragedy.
Talk about encroachment.
What
jurisdiction is the key.
Tragedy, yeah.
Jurisdiction
this
is.
This is a local county that's telling these 2,000 acres, one of the biggest organic farms in the country, right, that they need to get rid of these weeds, these pesky weeds.
And get some Roundup.
And get some Roundup on there. But I think there's going to be enough pushback. I've seen this thing floating around the internet for a week. I think they're going to have a meeting on May 22nd. And if those of you would like to help, and just call somebody up there in Oregon. You can go on my Facebook page, Patrick Timpone. Scroll down a little bit, you'll find the whole story, and there's a link there, and they give you a phone number and also an email, and you can just write whatever you feel would be appropriate. I don't think they're going to get away with it. There's just too much press on it, but you never know, man.
That's right.
I mean, Oregon.
It's all about jurisdiction. You know, we talked about last
jurisdiction
week.
Meaning that if meaning. You got your form in Hays County where I am,
yeah,
they can pretty much do whatever they want.
Well,
I mean, that's what they think.
Who has jurisdiction over your property? Who gets to say what you can have or can't have on your property? Maybe some people like weeds. What if they want to grow them? So here in New Jersey, it's like settled law. There's no question. No one has even appealed any decision. They avoid me like the plague. But the idea of property maintenance laws where, hey, you have weeds on your lawn, they're going to blow into your neighbor's lawn. You have to kill those weeds. You must get those weeds out of your lawn. And so this is on a larger scale what's happening to these farmers. And as an organic farm, I can see where they're resistant to putting Roundup on any of their property.
You think?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, their whole business, but they've been in business 18 years. It's gone. Done. Poof.
Yeah, not organic
not
anymore.
Not organic anymore. You're done. How can they do that? I mean, well, I guess they're going to have to lawyer up and just try to stop this thing, I guess.
Sure.
I mean, wow.
Just all they need to do is start a church, the Church of the Organic Farm. Thou shalt not use any pesticide. And then just go in and claim a religious exemption from the law.
That's probably the best way to do that, huh?
Well, they seem to pay lip service to that, so.
Mm-hmm. We're getting a bunch of questions on this, and I don't know what you know about it, but this is one of about three. Andrew, what computer precautions did Andy apply to protect against encryption? Could he give us some tips? And another one wants to know if he thinks that this whole hacking thing was a real thing or a false flag. So,
okay, so on the hacking thing, what did I apply?
Mm-hmm.
I use what no one else does. If you've ever heard of Linux, L-I-N-U-X.
I have it.
Yeah,
my head explodes when I even think about it.
Yeah, yeah. So it's basically the counter computer. So my computer is such that the servers run on Linux, and then within the Linux are virtual machines that run PCs and Macs. So it's called Hackintosh, play on the hacking of the Macintosh. So by using an unorthodox computer, they would have to alter all of their programs just to get to mine. So, unless somebody, which I'm even prepared for that, targets me and individually decides to hack my system, then they have to deal with my security measures, which I won't go into here. But needless to say, we were not victims of the hacking and ransomware attack, nor do we anticipate ever being. We have bulletproof encryption. We have, the most advanced and sophisticated computer technology for security that there is, and pay a lot of money to do it, because when computers first came out and I wanted to use them, I understood what my clients value more than anything is privacy. And if I have their information, then I'm going to secure it and guard it with my life. And that's what we've done. So protect the data. That's our motto. And we have a whole IT department, which many companies don't. You know, they bring in outside people. We actually have inside people inside the house that their whole job is protecting and taking care of the network.
And I read, is this correct, that Microsoft actually even put out a patch for this thing?
Right away.
Some time ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes most people don't do the patches.
Of course not.
But if you do Microsoft Essentials, I probably got the patch. Right?
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
Yes,
now, you told me about that one, and that's a good one, isn't it?
It is a good one.
Yeah. And it's
thank
free.
Goodness.
It's free.
And it's free. And
Microsoft Essentials.
And because it is Microsoft's business to make sure no one hacks their stuff, they're pretty, diligent about getting these patches in place, although there are some that have gotten past them. But the point here is that if you're going to develop a hacking system, you're going to develop it for the number one computer software on the marketplace, which is Windows. And so if you attack the vulnerabilities in Windows, there's your most likely target. You have Windows computers all over the world. But if you're going to put together a hacking system that targets Linux, you'd be lucky.
You
if
only
you
get
find,
12 people.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
So let's see. So
I just don't make myself an easy target.
Right. So those of us that use Microsoft Essentials, we're covered on this little whatever ransomware thing.
If
right?
you've done your
due
diligence,
that does it automatically.
Yeah, well, if you've checked
times
it to
a week.
Do automatically.
Oh, it does. Yeah, I see my
if
little
you have it, but, you know, people who don't want to be bothered, they tell it never
check. Well,
it does
it in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
What does it matter?
And you have to leave your computer on. And, mm-hmm. You know, that I started my computer.
Well, I think you should leave your computer on anyway.
Well, most people don't. See, they
you
use
should.
It. I know you should. I was just going
to
say.
Tell them about that, because that's the way to save your computer. Don't turn it off and on.
Every time you turn your computer off, there are capacitors inside your computer that decompress. And every time you turn it on, they compress. So that fluctuation, that expand, contract, causes failure. So I turn mine on once, and they stay on.
They stay on, yeah.
They've been on. I have computers that have been on for 10 years. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
And that's the other problem, of course. Most people use the spinning drives, which are prone to failure. That's hardware failure. We've long since moved to solid-state drives.
Good for you.
Which don't spin, and they're not noisy. So anyway.
Yeah. Well, you're a good geek, man.
If you're going to use computers, it's just like back in the days when automobiles first came out.
You got to know how
to. If you're going
to
own an auto, you better know how to fix it. If you're going to own a computer, you better know how it works and how to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Macs are that much far advanced as far as the PC, the Dells and the HPs?
No.
They're just cool.
No, it's just that the market share, again, if you're going to put software out there that's automated, right, that's going to exploit the vulnerabilities in a particular system,
mm-hmm.
It's just like writing software for everything else. You write a version for the Mac, and you write a version
sure.
for the PC.
Sure.
And so because of that, most hackers don't go to the trouble of bothering with the Mac, at least they haven't in the past. As it gains market share, they, of course, are doing it, but the harsh reality is that the bulk of viruses are aimed at PC-based, Windows-based computers because mm-hmm. that's what there's the most of,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
one size fits all.
The challenge with the Microsoft Essentials, though, is that every now and then somebody comes by your house, you know, and they knock on the door and they want to give you a vaccine.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Okay. Well, I like to get a little dig at
a little dig at Bill.
Bill,
whenever
you
can.
Whenever
you
can, just because, you know, he's got $48 billion.
He has his mission.
Yeah.
They've given him his mission.
Yeah.
This is your...
Bill.
Look, we're going to sell you DOS.
That's it.
Just like tell Ted Turner, we're going to sell you DOS, Bill.
We're going to sell you CNN.
We'll sell you CNN. Exactly.
You're not suggesting that Bill and maybe Ted Turner...
We're both.
...could be...
agents.
Or maybe Zuck could be made men, are you?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Really?
Their early funding
Can
came
I quote
from...
You? Is that
and
off
yes,
the record?
Yes, you know, that's on the record.
Oops.
You may quote me.
Yeah.
Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, mm-hmm. and...
Ted Turner,
no doubt, were provided their opportunity in exchange for the end payment. In the case of Ted Turner, it was giving
you
the
know
money
what the end payment there was
to the UN. Holy cow!
Oh, that's
man.
Right. Tell that story because that's amazing.
Well, he got rich. He bought himself some land in New Mexico.
Yeah.
He kept enough money to live on,
mm-hmm.
and then gave the rest of it to the UN.
And then the rest went to Jane.
She had her own money.
She had her own money.
And in the case of Bill, you know,
Isn't
he made all
amazing
this money.
That was part of the deal.
Yeah, well, I think it was.
It had to be. He gave.
And, you know, in the case of
Bill Gates.
DOS, the disk operating system that he based his entire business on.
Did he invent that or did
Al Gore? It was the property of IBM.
Oh.
Which was notoriously corrupted by government money.
IBM was.
Notoriously.
Really?
During World War II and even parts of World War I, they were gateways and conduits for intelligence apparatus.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, man, you're crushing my vision here.
They picked
I remember
the guy.
Those commercials. IBM, yeah.
Yeah, and so Bill Gates was sold DOS by accident, according to...
By accident.
Yeah, well, they didn't realize what they were selling him. Sure.
Sure.
Yeah, $300 I think was the number.
You're kidding.
It was like looking back, you know, oh gosh, the guys at IBM must have been really stupid or really smart. And so here, Bill, we're going to sell you this, but remember, down the line.
Amazing. And the story is that Bill, he kind of stole the whole Windows idea of little things in the mouse's stuff from Jobs, right?
Wozniak, I thought.
Oh, Wozniak, was, right, yeah. Right. The Steve Jobs' partner.
Partner.
Yeah, he went to see it and said, oh, that's cool. I think I'll do that.
Yeah, I'll just do it that way.
I wonder if that's true. Well, maybe we could have Woz on the show someday and he'll
yeah,
tell
he's
us.
A bitter man. Doesn't talk about it too much.
He doesn't. How come? He's got $1 billion. What does he care?
Yeah, well, it was still painful. You know, some people still value integrity and friendship. And
Wozniak
was one of those.
So Steve didn't treat him right.
No, he didn't. No.
Yeah. Huh. It is the real world of money, man. We go some fun places with you, Andrew. Thanks. Come on and join the show. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Have a lot to do here yet this morning. Let's do a little thing here. Quick station break, and then we'll get into something fun.